Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you have anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech, our events we host, our consulting and advisory services, and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. Funding MedTech is our newest podcast that is a spinoff of our MedTech Money podcast series. Both Funding MedTech and MedTech Money can be found on the same podcast channel, so just search Funding MedTech and you will see all the episodes there. Funding MedTech is an interview-style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins. Building medtech companies the right way based on great technology is not a one-size-fits-all endeavor. McDonald Hopkins provides customized and proactive strategies that align clients' valuable medtech technology with their business goals. This, in turn, builds those clients into successful, thriving companies. With strong experience and depth in that startup world, venture capital, intellectual property, and fundraising arenas, McDonald Hopkins can be an important part of your team to help you develop the medtech business that you envision. In this episode, Susan Hsu at WIDIS and I discuss healthcare in the United States and its reimbursement maze, reimbursement of digital health products, what payers look for, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Susan Hsu. Susan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So Susan, an introduction into who you are, your background, and what you do.
Okay, I'm a healthcare reimbursement advisor working with medtech, diagnostic, and biotech companies navigating the healthcare reimbursement landscape. My career path spans from medical technology research and development, journalism, health policy, and also healthcare reimbursement consulting. So I recently published a book titled Healthcare's Reimbursement Maze, the ecosystem regulates market access to medical innovation in the US. I also founded WIDIS, a consulting firm where we apply strategies from the book to help speed up market access for healthcare startups and entrepreneurs. Really excited to share insights with you today.
Yeah, great. And is that book on Amazon? Can you order it on Amazon?
Yes, it's available on Amazon in both paperback and ebook.
Okay, great. Awesome. So Susan, your background, where are you located now? And you mentioned a lot of different things in your background there, including journalism. So I'm just curious, like maybe even some more details of what got you so interested in reimbursement in the US market.
Sure. Really happy to. So I currently based in Rockville, Maryland. It's part of a so-called DC metropolitan area. In the preface of the book, I actually shared about my journey of 10,000 miles. Now, in retrospective, it's really a journey preparing me to write the book. With a background in biomedical engineering, I began my career as a research scientist in research and development of medical technology. So medical technology and innovation has always held a special place in my heart. This explains my interest in the book's topic. And during my tenure as a research scientist, I took a side gig working as an editor and a reporter for a medtech industry magazine in China. Research work in a lab tends to focus on really narrow topics. While working at the magazine offered me a vantage point to see the broader healthcare and the innovation landscape. Also, the daily essay writing really proved to be an excellent training to improve my writing skills. I got interested in health policy during my time reporting on the SARS outbreak in 2003, 2 decades ago. SARS stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. Similar to COVID-19, SARS was also caused by a strain of a coronavirus and had a profound impact. It infected over 8,000 people, mostly in China, and claimed nearly 800 deaths. So the mortality rate of SARS is much higher than COVID, close to 10%. However, because most people will feel severely ill once have the symptoms, so it didn't spread as wide as COVID. So public policy was a relatively new topic in China at that time. Top universities had only started offering MPA program, Master of Public Administration. So I came to the US pursuing my MPA study. Over the past decade or so, I switched between the provider trade association and the consulting, really developed the expertise in healthcare reimbursement, which includes an understanding of the value expectations from payers and providers, detailed knowledge of coding, payment, and coverage, and also research and analytical skills to deal with evidential requirements. So through my consulting work, I saw firsthand the struggles of healthcare entrepreneurs and startups with navigating healthcare reimbursement. That was a motivating factor for me to write the book, which aims to provide an overview of the complex reimbursement landscape. That brings me here today for the conversation.
Yeah, so that's obviously specific, the book specific to the U.S. healthcare system. I'm curious, I want to start with, we're going to dive into U.S. and focus there, but how familiar are you with like China's reimbursement system? I'm curious on like, it's pretty well known how U.S. compares to Europe. And I've had those discussions before about maybe how, you know, the healthcare system works in like the UK or the EU. How does it compare from US to China? Is China as complex as the US? Is it more complex? I guess, what's your comfort level talking about that?
It's always a yes and no. They have a different flavor of a complexity. In the U.S., you know, we can dive into that later. It's more like the system have more players. In China, is government definitely set the tone of the kind of a policy. But you also have to think that they are young, a fast changing system. You know, China kind of transformed from when I grew up, it's more kind of a healthcare system attached to a planned economy. Actually, the SARS outbreak served as a wake-up call. So in the before the 1980s, that's what the system basically, they set up a system in the rural area, for example, they down to the village, but that is financed under the old communal kind of planned economy. But when the country opened up, privatized their entities, the old financing system just collapsed. By the time of the SARS outbreak, they did a lot of reflection and realized in the country there are so little people have any insurance coverage, and the hospitals are operating in a quasi public owned system, even though they have some finance support from the government, but they also have to rely on their own. So they surcharge certain health services like drugs, prescription drugs, and then people are afraid to go to hospitals because they will get huge bills. And then, you know, after the SARS outbreak, the government they really increase investment in healthcare. And they start with, now the more than 95% of the Chinese citizens have some sort of insurance coverage. But then they start facing the issue of aging. China is a developing country, but with a fast aging population. And then how to make the insurance kind of scheme really work. And then there recently have a lot of changes. The government step in, try to curb some of the more profit-driven behavior from the healthcare providers. And then, yeah, so it's kind of a, they are different system. It's more, in some way, more close to the Europe because they have a central, more centralized decision makers. But, you know, they also studied the U.S., the European countries. For example, I participated in some discussions a while ago about the DRG payment system. It's a diagnostic related group that first developed in the U.S. and still used in the U.S. to pay for inpatient care. So they adopt some of the systems, but then they also build something for their own needs.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, so with the, we've done a few episodes now at this point when this one gets released on reimbursement. But one place I wanted to really, so we've kind of set the basics for what reimbursement looks like in the US and CPT codes and Q codes and all these different kinds of codes, right? Of mechanically how companies bill insurance technically. But I'm interested, the one thing I wanted to, you know, talk to you is, we talk to early stage startups a lot where they will come to us and say, well, there's already a code to get reimbursed for my product. And I said, that's great. That's a great first step. However, you also have to prove to an insurance company that they should pay for your product, right? And so I'm curious for you, the biggest question is, you know, how does one convince healthcare providers to use their new medical product? And that includes the physicians, but it really also includes, like, how do you convince insurance to cover your product?
Okay, that's a great question. So in the book, I definitely dive into the evidential requirements from payers and providers. So there are multiple layers of questions, right? So first, when you say there are a code available, you first have to confirm, depending on the indication of your technology, the settings where your technology is used, you may or may not be able to use the existing code. So definitely confirm that. After that, then the question is, do you need a new code? Do you need a new payment? Do you need a new coverage determination? That's generally the first step. Try to figure out your reimbursement pathway. And then along that line, there is kind of a, in terms of payer and provider relationships, you have to understand that are you eligible to receive reimbursement directly. There are some type of technology I will be able to. For example, I mentioned in some of the software as a service or software as medical device field, there is one category called independent diagnostic test facility. It's equivalent to, for example, traditionally, there it may be an imaging center of a CT or some scans, and the providers prescribe and send the patient to there, and they can bill. That's also more typical in the laboratory diagnostic testing world, that the lab can directly bill for their service. But most of the medical technologies, they actually, what we normally refer, that a provider plays the role as a buy and a bill. So providers, whether it's hospitals or physicians, they purchase a medical tech knowledge and then to provide the services and then bill for the insurance for the services provided. In that case, they also have two tracks. One is that the service actually can directly reimburse it. Explicitly, there is reimbursement. Then you have to think about how to make sure that the provider will be reimbursed for that. And then another is that actually it's just pure cost for the providers to provide the services. So then you think about when you talk about the evidence, the different type of the services will have a little bit different evidential requirement. For the one that provider can bill for the service, you have a little bit, then the case mostly you have to make to the payers. And then for Medicare, for example, they do have their evidential requirements. And they generally the term is reasonable and necessary. One kind of type of a mistake I saw some of the health startups, they thought that they can just use the studies or results they submitted to FDA used for the payers. It may or may not work depending on the type of technology and the type of study you produced. On a high level, the difference, the evidential requirements between FDA and CMS, for example, is that the payers focus on something called a clinical utility. What that means is that the FDA focus on safety and effectiveness. So there are some overlapping area. However, FDA may focus on, okay, if for a diagnostic test, whether you can diagnose a disease accurately. Well, CMS will ask whether the information, diagnosis, result findings is actionable clinically. And then what's the outcome of the actions? Like if the physician changed their treatment plan, that's the first layer. And then whether treatment plan generate a better outcome for patients. So that's a kind of the nuance between the evidential requirement between the FDA and the payers. And then Medicare, in terms of evidential requirement, Medicare generally is not allowed to consider costs in making coverage decisions. However, private payers do. So many of the private insurance may ask for a cost-effective analysis that to see, you know, what the cost impact of adopting a new technology. They may have internal thresholds for coverage. So it's on the payer side. In terms of providers, their evidence requirement is a little bit broader. Certainly, they also asking the first question is whether the technology is going to do what you mean to do, and whether they will improve patients' outcome. That's kind of a bit similar to the payer side. Generally means you need to show some published studies on that. But then they may also interest in whether a new product is going to improve patient satisfaction, improve staff retention, make their operation more efficient. For example, in the inpatient setting, that means whether you have a shorter length of stay, because the hospital are paid a flat rate for diagnosis-related group. If you either, no matter the patients spend 5 days or 10 days in the hospital, so if you can shorten the length of stay, you also help improve their bottom line. And there are also a lot on the operation side, whether, you know, you can improve the operation room, shorten the operation room use. Also, there are cost consideration for sure. And for the providers, they may have their own return on investment analysis, because now the revenue is come from payers and the product is a cost. So we sometimes help the companies develop ROI more tailored for each healthcare providers using their data. So that is, and those also, there are a lot of different cost factors like supplies, trainings, maintenance of the new technology. So then they now add, the transition of to value-based care. Then the hospitals or health system may also interest in a little bit long-term impact instead of just the immediate use of a medical device. They may consider factors like whether it's going to improve episode care cost or even the total cost of care.
Yeah, this is great. So a few questions within that explanation there. If I'm a startup company and I'm looking at this very like analytically, right? I understand, for the FDA, if I want to meet with the FDA, who's going to judge my product on safety and effectiveness, there's ways for me to engage them prior to an actual submission, right? There's pre-submission meetings, there's 513Gs, there's a number of different things you can do to engage and get some feedback. From a physician or hospital standpoint, there's also very open ways for you to engage with them and say, hey, what are the problems you're facing? Would this make sense? Would you want to see anything else from this product, right? There's a lot of different ways to engage. I'm curious, and this is just because I'm not familiar with it potentially, what are ways for you to engage the payers ahead of time so you can get a feel for, hey, if I'm building my clinical trial right now for the FDA, I can also build in these endpoints to make sure I address certain things that you're going to want to see before you give us that stamp of approval of yes, we'll pay for your product.
Sure, it's a great question. So there are multiple ways to engage payers. I kind of just focused on the Medicare side. So there is actually something called a parallel review, which FDA and CMS when you submit to FDA, and then you can participate in the parallel review, where it means that CMS will access the evidence simultaneously with FDA, and then they will provide feedback. In the past, we have seen in some coverage determination, that means that when the FDA approval when FDA approved a product, then CMS can open a coverage determination immediately, can shorten the process by a couple months. But also, they actually have information sessions. You can reach out to them. The local coverage was MAC, the Medicare Administrative Contract. They make a local coverage determination. You can reach out to them for informational session. That's kind of achieve that. In terms of the pain, these are the coverage side. You can reach out to them. Even the National Coverage Determination, they also encourage you to reach out to them first to assess whether. First, whether you need a coverage determination. Second, whether you have the evidence to really get through the coverage determination, all kind of question. And this is on coverage side. On the payment side for Medicare, this always a public process. It's generally they issue anything, a proposed rule. And then you have 60 days to submit your comment often. And then they will finalize the policy. Certainly, there are certain deadlines. If you want to get, for example, new code, when this code is managed by CMS, they have a deadline. They have an application form to get through a certain cycle. That's actually one thing that you can reach out to them too. Some of the MAC actually can give you preliminary feedback. For example, whether you can use a certain code. Certainly, if it's related to CPT, then you reach out to the EMA. If it's a HCPCS code, you reach out to CMS, those sort of thing. You do can engage with payers.
Great. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there is that open stream of communication there. You mentioned diagnostic a few times so far, and I think you said DRG codes. I'm familiar with some of the device ones, and I think if others who are listening and want more information on device, there's even more other episodes we've done, and then you've done a good job of outlining that. How is diagnostic reimbursement different? And also, I think the same question goes for that I asked for device, which is, how do you convince a payer to pay for it? It sounds like they want to know, is you know, if you're a diagnostic, are you going to influence a clinical decision and get a better outcome? But just curious, you know, how do you convince payers on the diagnostic side, and how are diagnostics reimbursed? And I guess, yeah, dive into that information.
Okay. So when I say diagnostic related group, DRG is a system that group patients into categories to do, that's a particular use in the, something called the inpatient prospective payment system, or IPPS, used to pay for inpatient stays. So that is actually introduce a question about a payment system and the coverage, right? So when the service is provided in the inpatient setting, provider are paid as episode-based care, cover the time from the admission to discharge. Generally, the technology used in inpatient stay, provider will procure the technology and then bill for service. So you may not need a particular coding, depends on the technology. There are some new technology that you basically open a new line of surgery, then you need a coverage. But there are other things that you don't necessarily need a coverage, but to encourage adoption of more innovative technology, under the IPPS, there are something called a new technology add-on payment, NTAP. So then it's a transitional, it's generally just 2 or 3 years to provide some additional reimbursement for providers when they adopt new technology, likely to add the cost of the service. One example I discuss in the book is VZAS Wieslaw, which is a technology that can help identify stroke patients, the patients with a higher risk of stroke in the emergency room, so that then the patient, the hospital can respond faster. Then the AI basically analyzing their imaging data and alert physicians that patients with a higher risk of a stroke. So they get NTAP add-on payment for a couple of years, which is it's a good marketing tool. Basically, they provide some additional buffer for the providers if they use new technology, going to increase their payment, and also it's a recognition of it's a very innovative technology. So that is for inpatient setting. I also discussed some two other examples like IDXDR, which is a diagnostic tool to identify patients, basic diabetes patients with higher risk of diabetic. It's a condition that can cause visual loss or blindness. I think it was a term for it. So that's the first test received the Category 1 CPT code and has been reimbursed by Medicare, and both the physician fee schedule, PFS, and also hospital outpatient prospective payment system, or OPPS. So another software-based diagnostic tests like heart flow, they also received a reimbursement under PFS and OPPS, but with a Category 3 CPT code or temporary code. So for IDRDX, I think they go through the normal process to apply a Category 1 code, and then the physician fee schedule have a process to price for the new code, and then just get that through the reimbursement process, payment process. In terms of heart flow, they request, I think, the local coverage determination. And then and then they actually CMS granted a national payment for them. So you can see there are different pathway in terms of evidential requirement, particularly for diagnostic test. They actually, in terms of clinical utility, they actually have three layers. First, that if the test results change the clinician's clinical thinking. But I haven't seen any of the tests get covered by that one. But then another layer, that whether you change the clinician's a treatment plan. I did see some examples that they show, for example, when you provide a diagnostic test results, before that, the clinician plan to use treat this type of treatment. And then once they have this information, they change certain treatments. And then I saw a couple cases that actually diagnostic test was covered because of that kind of evidence. Then another layer of the evidence is really that diagnostic tech have a positive impact on the patients. Certainly, you know, when we're talking about a test result, you don't necessarily change, you know, you have to have a companion treatment plan, that the treatment plan is better. So it's they recognize their need another layer of the, you know, to achieve better outcomes. So that's why I think that sometimes I can accept that if you can change the treatment plan and you figure out whether there are better treatment for the patients.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And so I'll end with the last one, which is probably the hottest topic in healthcare, which is AI and software as a service, essentially, right? But tell me about AI, machine learning. How is that being reimbursed? And maybe give us some background there.
First I have to say is it's still in development. There are a couple cases, as I mentioned, IDRDX, the VZAI, they have some sort of established a reimbursement. But I think that the payer is still trying to figure out. One is that there may be changes down the road. The first thing is that, you know, for example, clinical decision support, you know, there is this type of software or system available for a long time. So the pair are trying to figure out to join the line between that. And in the past, those kind of clinical decision support generally viewed as the indirect cost of a service. Basically, you run the office, you have that software, and that's part of running the business. They do reimbursement that, but it's different than treated the direct cost. For example, you do an imaging test for a particular patient. It's not just the administrative cost of running an office. So that is one line. I think that AMA actually have started kind of a structure the AI into different buckets. Assistant or automated is kind of a spectrum in terms of AI services. So far, the justification for paying for AI service, their CMS normally said it's FDA approval. So in the past, the clinical decision support do not necessarily require FDA approval for that decision support. So this is one. Also, it's coding. In the past, you don't necessarily have a separate code for clinical decision support. So that is the current state. As I said that, you know, there are so many different AI applications. I feel like they fill the spectrum from assistant, like more traditional clinical support to automated diagnostic, like IDX DR. They can directly generate diagnostic recommendations without intervention of the physicians or clinicians. That's kind of something is still developing, may influence the reimbursement in the future. In terms of payment, so far there are still within the existing kind of a reimbursement framework, depending on the setting, who is using it. So then which payment system you fall under with the coding system. Haven't really see a kind of across different sectors or payment system and kind of a cross board policy.
Yeah, very cool. So Susan, in kind of wrapping things up here, can you, if I'm a startup company listening in right now, I'm in the med tech diagnostic software as a service device industry, what are things, what's the number one thing I should be concerned with? What's your best piece of advice for me as an early stage entrepreneur on making sure that all my boxes are checked so that I can have a successful commercial launch of my product when it comes time for it?
So, you know, in the last chapter of the book really discussed strategies to navigate the healthcare reimbursement maze. So if I boil down, you know, the 20 pages of discussion into one advice, I would say develop a healthcare reimbursement strategy, basically a game plan sooner rather than later. So the reimbursement planning process really just brings the perspective of payers and providers with a goal of market access. I often say that, you know, when we think about a consumer, we normally think about the individuals who order, pay for, and use a product. However, in the context of healthcare, those roles are played by different stakeholders. You know, payer pay basically cover a significant portion of the cost of medical technology. And in terms of ordering a new technology, generally, you need prescriptions from a clinician. So they are all consumers, right? In healthcare, payers, providers, and patients, they are all consumers. So you want to bring their perspectives into the development of a new technology so that you can shape the product into a more marketable product that really create values for payers, providers, and patients. So I think you should consider that early on when you have more kind of a flexibility to shape a product.
Awesome. Also, keep going.
Yeah, so also having an idea of you know, potential reimbursement data and issues before committing to a course can save you a lot of time and money. You know, we have seen some, like, for example, if the technology is not going to be covered at a benefit category, you have to anticipate a much longer time to get it covered. Also, you know, sometimes when you're having a reimbursement strategy alongside the regulatory process, like when you just start to think about developing the clinical trial for FDA approval, for example, when you also think about the reimbursement evidential requirement, you really can kind of develop the evidence in a more coordinated way. Also think about the pricing and the marketing strategy. So, you know, I think it's important to have early plan. Instead of the kind of a common mistake I saw many companies doing is just they get to the stage, like they, after the FDA, they start to think of a reimbursement and then realize, oh, I don't have the evidence to submit for the payers. And then the evidence development can take at a minimum 2 or 3 years. If you're lucky, can take much longer. And then I see companies just stay there for a couple of years without moving. And then when they get to the, after they got coverage, they start to think about providers, how to convince providers to prescribe it. And then they realize, oh, they see things differently. For example, they have a different view about alternative treatment. They compare you to alternative treatments and other factors too. And then you start to think about, oh, how could I develop those evidence? And then you sit there for a couple of years before you really have bring that technology to patient care. So definitely start sooner and you will save time down the road.
Awesome. Susan, I appreciate this so much. Have links to the book, your consulting website, your LinkedIn, all in the show notes. Thanks so much for sharing your background knowledge with the audience today and me. I learned a ton. So Susan, hang on for 1 minute. We'll chat offline. But thanks again for being a guest on the Project MedTech podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.